Welcome to Literary Arts, the Archive Project. I'm Andrew Proctor, Executive Director of Literary Arts. The Archive Project is a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers from more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. This episode features a conversation between Sandra Cisneros and Elena Passarello from Woodstock in 2015. Cisneros is probably best known for her book, The House on Mango Street, and for being the first Chicana to get a publishing contract from a major publishing company. She's published 10 books and has influenced a generation of writers with her fiction, poetry, and nonfiction. To many, she represents the possibility that not only could a Hispanic or Latino writer be published and become famous, but they could do so by telling their own stories. And yet, for all her stature and accomplishments, her humility, humor, and passion are on full display in this conversation. She's in conversation with Elena Passarello, who is the author of two books and a finalist for an Oregon Book Award and the winner of a Whiting Award. At the center of their conversation is Cisneros' book, A House of My Own, Stories from My Life. We get to hear about her early days as a writer, her influences, and most importantly, why Cisneros thinks writing matters. Now, from Woodstock, Portland's Book Festival in 2015, here's Sandra Cisneros and Elena Passarello in conversation.
So a lifelong dream for me to speak in a church. It's a very beautiful church. And I don't know what denomination this is, but I know they allow women to speak, I think, right? And very nice to be in a church where women can speak up. All right, I'm going to read a piece that I think is appropriate for a book festival. And it's about, there's lots of entries in here that deal with other artists, because we forget that artists are influenced by artists, not necessarily the same medium. And I've often been influenced by singers like Maria Callas, or actresses like Anna Magnani, and all kinds of people, Amy Winehouse, all kinds of people that I think are fabulous, Billie Holiday. So anyway, I want to read something about a Argentine musician and composer who was a great influence in my writing. And this was, I don't need to tell you about it, I just need to read it. I'm not used to reading sitting down, but I will do my best. I met the Argentine tango composer and musician Astor Piazzolla in 1988 on a Sunday, April 24th, at the Great American Music Hall on O'Farrell Street, San Francisco. I'm sure of the date because I have a signed flyer to prove it. I needn't have bothered. The date is engraved in my corazón. The year before, I'd barely survived the 33rd year of my life, a time when you die and hopefully are resurrected. So 1988 was the year of my resurrection. I remember driving the 5 hours from Chico, California, where I was a guest professor, convinced Astor Piazzolla, the man who had revolutionized tango, had come to California to meet me. The year of my near death, I'd lost my purpose for living. I know it sounds overly dramatic, but that's the truth. I was tired of the nuisance of staying alive. I couldn't understand why I was put on the planet if I couldn't seem to do anything that would earn me my keep. I was weepy and nervous and skittish as a cat. In Texas, I'd been without a job for almost a year. A friend teaching at Cal State Chico was taking a temporary leave, and he had recommended me for his position. The last thing I wanted was to teach at a university. I'd never felt at home there. The truth was, I didn't feel smart enough as a student, let alone as a professor. Yet here was a job at a university being offered to me. I was so broke, I was forced to overlook my terror and take it. I borrowed money from my family for the umpteenth time, dragged my thrift store furniture in a trailer, and soon discovered what I had feared all along. I was a failure. The lethargy of my freshman composition students compared to the adults I taught at community centers convinced me I was no good, I was worthless, I was a dud. At least that was the way I saw it then. And if I wasn't any good at teaching, and if I was 33 years old and still borrowing to get by, and so what if I'd written a book that earned me hardly enough to cover a few months' rent? And I hated being in academia, feeling like I had to know everything when I hardly knew anything. And what if I was discovered for being the fraud I was? And if I had to borrow money from my family one more time, well, I'd lost my will to go on. But a National Writing Award arrived in the nick and reminded me why I was put on the planet. And now, here I was, and here he was, Astor Piazzolla, one of the greatest musicians and composers of the new tango, the greatest, in my opinion, coming to play for me. I'd been introduced to the music of Piazzolla in my mid-20s by my nemesis, the Zapata of my heart, who inspired several poems and stories in my travels through Europe so that I might become exactly like him, worldly and sophisticated instead of the naive fraidy cat I was. Piazzolla's music, a tempest of notes, came by way of this man, my lover, who in a sense was the same as the music. A yelp caught somewhere between pain and pleasure, a howl filled with longing and despair, the little burn a mouth leaves on the flesh, intense, tender, comical, ferocious, faithless, and ultimately doomed. All of this haunts me when I listen to Piazzolla's compositions, merging the traditional Buenos Aires tango with New York avant-garde jazz. Piazzolla taught me how to become the artist I wanted to become. "It's like this, you fool," I imagine Piazzolla saying. "Listen," and the yowl of his bandoneon, a collision of beauty and tragedy blended bloody together, became my teacher. I was hungry to serve my apprenticeship. When I was lost, sad, defeated, frustrated with my writing, with my life, I had only to listen to Piazzolla's music, and it would shine a light beam into the night, an arrow piercing a target, a guide as pure and steady as the North Star. This explains my supreme arrogance and naivete in the darkness of the Great American Music Hall that day in 1988. El maestro emerged on stage, all in black, as black as his bandoneon, dignified, divine. Then he began. A music that rose up, terrible like a knife held at one's own heart. Weepy, melodramatic, corny, wonderful, all at once. Violin, bandoneon, cello, piano like rain. I had to stand up and lean against a pillar, blow my nose with a cocktail napkin. When the lights blinked on for intermission, I took off backstage. I wasn't drunk. How to explain the absolute confidence of my mission? I shoved the swinging doors that separated the gods from the rabble and marched right in. Surprisingly, there were no security guards. No bouncers or police, no one. Just a sad, empty corridor, too shabby to shelter greatness. Outside an open doorway, I heard voices and suddenly lost my courage. Then the outrageousness of my actions caught up with me. Astor and his musicians were probably exhausted and taking a well-deserved break. I was at a loss at what to do next. Luckily, somebody appeared to solve the problem, a young guy with the same idea of meeting his idol as me, but with more bravado. We started jabbering loud enough so that eventually Piazzolla popped out to see why we were there. The fan knew exactly what he wanted. He asked for an autograph and handed Piazzolla a cheap yellow flyer announcing the evening's event. What else could I do but get ready to do the same? But what would I say to him? First, I had to tell him. I had to tell him what I'd been holding in my heart all these years. I wanted to say, Astor, your music has bored me through so many disappointments, through the exploding cigars of love, through near deaths, through my own death and resurrection. I traveled to find myself when I listened to your music. It was your music I listened to for courage when I first arrived on the Greek islands in the Aegean and on the boat that pulled me away from Greece, where I finally finished my first novel. And on the cold nights in Paris, when I didn't have any money and was sleeping on the floor of the Argentines, Astor, you don't know. It's been so hard to invent myself and become the writer I've wanted to become. I've had to run away from home. I had to buy a one-way ticket to Athens because I'd never been anywhere alone before, even though I was almost 30. And when I was washing my socks in the sink on a cold winter morning in Chicago or in Tuscany, in the pre-Alps of southern France or in South Texas, riding across town on a bicycle or driving across country, Astor, you taught me with your music the kind of passion I wanted to reach in my work. I'm aware, Astor, you struggle to find your own voice, how your teacher, Nadia Boulanger, advised you to take up the instrument you had abandoned because you were embarrassed by the bandoneon. She was reminding you to remember who you are and making you feel less ashamed and praising you for being no one but you, and sent you back to that despised part of yourself because it was you had abandoned. And in that monster of a box, you'd been able to leap from the sentimental to sentiment, which is a fine line. And how the traditionalists wanted to murder you for what you did to their tango. And how it had been so hard for me to become a writer. But your music, Astor, your music had shown me when I was cold and afraid to be fearless. You made the tango yours, Astor, and it became mine the years of my 20s. And now, in my early 30s, having just barely escaped the maw of death, that terror was in your music, Astor. Everything was in your music. The nemesis I loved, who abandoned me, and how from that open wound, I had transformed the yelp into a howl. And that howl was my work, inspired by you, Astor. Do you understand? All this, I thought, while the guy in front of me was getting his flyer signed. And now, it was my turn. And Astor Piazzolla, in his black trousers with their sharp creases, in his silky black shirt, and polished black boots, Astor, with only his hands and face illuminating the moment, was reaching out and taking my flyer from my hand. I stood there with my mouth open a little. Now, as he signed, I needed to tell him. It was my chance, yes, I could say it now, I could tell him, now! Señor Piazzolla, I said breathlessly, your work is my life. He nodded, passed my flyer on down the line to his fellow musicians to sign, and then my moment was gone. I clenched that autographed flyer in one fist and wobbled back to my seat, feeling foolish and weepy. Your work is my life. What was I thinking? Then I put my head down to write. Thing in my shoe, dandelion thorn thumbprint, one grain of grief that has me undone once more. Oh, my father, heartily sorry I am for this right side of the brain, who has alarmed and maimed and laid me many a day now invalid low. And when I raised my head, I had a new book of poetry. Just as if I'd gone through childbirth, my body changed, startling me with flesh where I'd once had bone. I put my head down again, and again when I raised it, another book, and again my body altered, so that I was no longer myself, but a woman staring at a woman from the other side of water. Books and more books, and more changes to the house one calls the self. Young people get in line to meet the author and have their book autographed. I am the author they've come to meet. Some of them barely able to talk, their eyes like ships lost at sea. You don't know what this means to me, they say, fumbling with the page they want me to sign. You just don't know.
One of my favorite things about Astor Piazzolla is when, in the middle of playing, he'll just go, right? I wish we could do that in writing.
Or there's pauses, and then he'll just like hit something.
Yeah, he slaps, yeah.
Yeah. It's like, oh, I didn't know you could do that.
I feel like neither of those things are very possible or as possible in writing as they are in music, which I wonder.
No. Actually, he teaches you so much about the white space on the page, because in music it's all about tempo and pauses and crescendos. And so he taught me a lot. You know, when I'm stuck or I'm feeling lost, I just listen to him or Maria Callas, and, you know, it's like, okay, that's what I want. Yeah. That's
one of the most beautiful things about this book, I think, are these lovely three-page interludes of influences from visual art, from music, from film. And I wonder, there's Chavela Vargas and Marguerite Duras and lots of visual artists from San Antonio.
Photographers. I'm a big lover of film and photography. And I think in the next collection, because I want to do like a part two on lovers and mentors, which will be called Exploding Cigars and North Stars, you know. that's another book. And I just have lots of ideas because I grew up in Chicago in poor neighborhoods, poor schools, but with great museums. And the museums were important in shaping us. You know, my mother had to get out of the house every Sunday, and she took us for her own sake, and we just tagged along. So, you know, I got all this great education from, you know, the Mary Cassatts and the Japanese prints and the gem room, you know, so a lot of places for similes from just being in these great museums.
And do you find yourself seeking non-written inspirations when you're
working?
Yeah,
because, you know, I wanted to, you know, we all start out as visual artists, you know, as Picasso says, we all draw. And why we stop, you know, he asked the question, why do we stop, though? And so I always was a visual artist before I claimed words. And I still feel very close to photography and film and I love museums. But, you know, a whole generation of us, our life was enriched thanks to museums being free on the days that working class people had the day off, not on Thursdays, you know, Sundays. Yeah. I think, you know, if museums, maybe they don't realize how much they enrich the lives of children. I'm sure the museum staffs go crazy with children running through the halls and screaming, but you take in so much when you're running through the halls, you know, and screaming. You know, I loved going to the Field Museum and with the dinosaurs, and we loved going into the basement where they would put the mummies in the basement so that it was like you were entering a tomb. It was really spooky for us as kids, and we loved it. But now they put like the Burger King next to the mummies. So there are generations now who are going to associate hamburgers with the mummies, you know? You know?
The mummies smell like Whoppers.
Yeah. I had an experience meeting Toni Morrison in the basement bathroom there, and I was supposed to come out and be on a panel with all these Olympians, you know, Toni Morrison, and I forgot who else, but, you know, Toni Morrison, you don't forget. But I remember that my father was sick, and my agent said, you know, you can do this, but I really couldn't. I kept telling her, I can't do this, and she was like, oh, yeah, you can do it. But I didn't know how to explain. I couldn't physically do it because I was in a state of grief. And if you don't have time or privacy to cry, you know, it'll come out in some way. So right before I was supposed to go on stage, this was for like the Democratic Convention, and the wife of a politico asked me, oh, what's your father sick from? And my father was dying, but I hadn't said it. And I said, oh, he has cancer. And then it just kind of came out of my mouth like vomit. And I said, excuse me. And I ran to the bathroom. I always carry little vintage handkerchiefs. Like, this is not a vintage, but little thin ones that are like, yeah. And I cried so much, I couldn't stop. You know, it was like like when a dog gets hit by a car and it goes into convulsions from here. And I remember that Anna Deavere Smith, for some reason, came in the bathroom. She wasn't on the stage, she was just there. And she came in, and I was like, and she was like, what's the matter? I was like, I couldn't say, I can't go on. And I just said, you know, please tell them I can't go on. So she was like, she ran out, and then she got Toni Morrison, and she came in. I was like, what? And you know, Toni Morrison is huge. So if I was going to draw this as a cartoon, I would be like that, Toni Morrison, you know, what's wrong? And I was like, I couldn't talk. It was so pathetic because I couldn't talk. And finally, I got out like a word, I can't go on. And then, and the whole handkerchief was like in those cartoons, it was all wet and you could have wrung it. And then she did something very interesting. She grabbed me and she hugged me and she said, mourn, mourn. And meanwhile, I was so embarrassed because I could smell Whoppers, hamburgers, and, you know, the mummies where I'd been in my childhood, and there was Toni Morrison hugging me, and I knew the absurdity and the tragedy, which is all of life, was happening at that moment, and I couldn't talk to say thank you. I just looked, you know, and Toni Morrison, and then she laughed, and, you know. And then someone ran in, some aide, you know. Everybody kept running in to watch me. It was just embarrassing, you know. It's embarrassing. All these people ran in like, and then they would run out. Finally, like some aide came out and said, there's a car waiting for you. You don't have to go on. And as soon as she said that, it was like I stopped. All the tears just stopped. And I thought, oh, what just happened? You know, I have to write about that for the next book.
Absolutely,
you know?
It's like absolutely.
You know, you tell these stories, and you keep telling them, and every time you tell them, you learn how to tell it, because you can do them out loud, but then you have to transfer it. Like this Piazzolla took me a long time before I could get it on the page and get the ending, as we had a different ending when I used to talk it.
And now I have 9 million questions. How do you find a way to move from the orality, you're such a wonderful storyteller, to the written page?
Well, first you have to tell the story. I really feel, and I said this last night, that, you know, there's an epigraph at the beginning. I always mix them up with epigram.
Me too.
Yeah, epigraph at the beginning of
this book. An epitaph.
An epitaph, that's right. Epigraph at the beginning of this book that's from Federico Fellini, the filmmaker, and he said the pearl is the oyster's autobiography. And I think for all of us, stories enter us, especially the ones that are the real stories, the ones we wish we could forget, like grains of sand. And we have to cover them with the nacre. And, you know, each time we tell the story, it's like we're trying to survive the event. If you don't tell the story, it's this invading grain of sand that can poison you. So the oyster has to keep building a little shell around it. Each time you tell it, you know, it's a little lopsided, then it gets rounder and more perfect, and then there's this beautiful gift, and then you let it go. And I think, you know, the stories we don't talk about, they just stay there like little grains of sand and make us ill. We have to tell them either to a curandera or a therapist, or we have to keep telling them over and over, and they keep drifting away from what really happened, but I like to think that they become more truthful with time, that we finally can let them go and they become these little perlitas, these little pearls.
Do you find that most of your stories start as oral stories before they become written stories?
Yes, and sometimes I gather them from someone who tells me a beautiful story, and you know a beautiful story because you shut up, you know, and no one tells you to be quiet, you're just like, oh, You know, that's a good story, you know, when you are quiet or when you are telling it and everyone is quiet. That's the magic circle, no? The sacred circle.
Your comment about the Fellini epigram, epigraph, epitaph about autobiography made me think of something that happens a few pages later in A House of My Own, where you say in the introduction that writing an autobiography for you would be like making your own death shroud. And I wondered, what is this book, which is sort of these rescued, or not maybe not rescued.
Yeah, rescued pieces of nonfiction that I was losing. I was losing my nonfiction because I move a lot, and they were written B.C. before computers, you know. So I just kept losing them, and some have gotten lost. So I said, if I don't publish them, I'm not going to be able to find them.
So that's the impetus.
Yeah. You know, I move a lot and things get lost, and, you know, so I would speak something. I would know I'd have to speak to, say, for example, an audience in Bloomington, Indiana. So I'd say, well, I better write it down. So I would write down my comments and timidly entered into nonfiction, because I think nonfiction takes a lot of courage. You can hide behind poetry and fiction, but nonfiction, you know, when people ask you, is this true, is this you, you have to own up.
Right.
Yeah.
That leads me maybe to my last question, and I definitely want to have time for all of us to ask questions of Ms. Cisneros. These true stories, some of them you wrote down 10 years ago, 15 years ago,
30 years ago,
30 years ago, which is such a gift. And instead of editing them in certain places, there are these addenda. So at the bottom of a page that says, for example, I can't think of anything else I'd rather do than be a writer, there's a list at the bottom of like 16 things that you'd like to do now instead of being a writer, including being a judge on RuPaul's Drag Race, which I would like to sign up for as well. Right? Yeah, see? I think you're going to have to get in line there. Can you talk a little bit about that decision to not necessarily edit everything? There's also some feelings about members of your family where you're seeing them from a different lens now, like your maternal grandmother. Why did you decide to include these addenda rather than just overhaul the sentiment?
I think it's important to not tinker too much with the essays. I had to, you know, cut out repetitions, of course, and, you know, maybe alter sentences that I thought were ugly. But mainly, that's who I was. It's like a picture of yourself at 30 or, 33 or 40. You know, that's who you were. And you change your mind, you know, and you want to add things. Or you believe the story your family tells you at that age. And later when you're older, you realize, well, you know, consider the source. So you want to, you know, you want to say something, you know? So, you know, like, for example, my mom, she always had these horrendous things to say about her mother. Well, come on, daughters and mothers, you know, so you have to think about those things.
Yeah, totally. And we talk a lot in memoir and autobiography about honesty, right? This is honest. I think there's a special kind of honesty that exists when you see the former sentiment and the later sentiment. Like the discrepancy between the two feels very honest to me.
You know, the writers I love are the ones that go back and revisit something they wrote about when they were younger, like Marguerite Duras writes The Lover, and, you know, as a response to The Seawall, something she wrote, a novel she wrote when she was really young. And then Christopher Isherwood, who I adore, you know, his Berlin stories, and then Christopher and His Kind. I would love, if I was teaching, to put the two together, but I don't like to teach, so I'm not going to do it, but I'll give it to you.
I'm stealing it right now.
Yeah, you know, to take these things that you write from different times, it wasn't that you were being dishonest when you were 20 or 25 or 30 or 35, it's just that you didn't have the long view. You didn't have the long view, so that's was your truth.
You could call this the long view,
I guess.
Okay.
And it's the short view if you know, one considers, I hope I'm still writing when I'm 85.
Yeah, we need that exploding cigar.
Yeah,
we need
that's
that
right.
Soon.
Yeah, I'm going to get to it. So, you know, I think you have to wait, too, because you can't write about things you're angry about and publish it when you're angry. You need to write when you're angry, and then you need to compost and keep writing and keep writing and keep writing and keep writing until you're not angry anymore and you understand the situation with clarity and generosity, and some little flower can grow out of that compost. So that's why you need the long view. No,
that's beautiful.
You know, you can't, there's enough evil in the world, you know, we don't need to add more.
Yay! What a wonderful thing to say in a church.
But I give people permission to begin wherever they are, wherever you are with your anger or your shame or your envy or whatever evil emotion you have, we all have them, that's where you start writing. You don't censor that. You tell the truth and you don't hurt anyone. And the way you don't hurt anyone is you don't have to show anyone that writing. I think that there's opposite things. There's writing and then there's being the author, and they're opposites. Because writing is about transforming these demons in your heart, transforming them before they transform you. That's real writing, to find out, to get clarity, to check in. You know, I wish people checked in their heart as often as they check their phone, you know? You know? Wouldn't that be
somebody
something?
Tweet that.
If we all checked into our hearts and spent time really like doing soul searching, which takes a long time. You can't do it in 3 seconds. You know, you need to sit there for a long time. So I think wherever you are, you be generous and compassionate to yourself, and you begin wherever you are. And if you don't have privacy, as I did not growing up, you know, you can tear up what you've written if it's too hurtful or frightening, or you can eat it, or you can have a ritual and burn it. But the most important thing is, and the real reason why we write, is to check in our hearts and to heal ourselves so we can go on living, so we won't die. We don't want to spiritually die. Anytime we create, it's nourishment for our spirit. Anytime you create. And becoming the author, if you think about that, you'll never write anything good. You know, never. Because real writing has to, you, we talked about this, is a daily practice of pushing away your ego. And your ego is thinking about the reader and the deadline and will I make any money and won't so-and-so be jealous, you know, all of that. You push that aside. And we talked about how I started doing that, and I'm going to tell you how to do it. I don't know how to meditate the way that real gurus meditate, but I do my own meditation, and I try to get in the zone in my own way. This is going to take too long to explain here, but one of the things I ask for when I do get into meditation is the two things that block me. I ask for humility, because that's the opposite of personal agenda. Ask for true humility, and ask for courage, because what you have to do when you write requires so much courage. And you're not alone when you're doing this writing. You can ask for your spirit allies, all your ancestors whose lives were harder than yours. All you're doing is pushing a pen across paper. That's not so difficult compared to jobs that our ancestors had, where they had to work with their hands and stand on their feet and wear out their bodies. So honor them and say, I need your courage. I need your strength. I want to do a page and a quarter, or whatever is your goal for just today. And I want to do it with true humility. I have this gift. How can I use it to serve? And you can be just serving yourself, you know, serving yourself to heal. And I always ask everybody, all the things I believe in, my father, my mother, all my grandfathers, all my grandmothers, if you believe in St. Michael, St. Francis, Virgin de Guadalupe, Guadalupe, whatever you believe in. If you don't believe in anything, everybody believes in love. So you can ask the power of love to help you forward. And then at the end, you know, you just close and say, I always say, ayúdame a ayudar, help me to help. Planet is such a horrible place. If I heal myself, I will make the planet better. Ayúdame a ayudar. And I close with gratitude, and then I do my page. And if you want to, you can light an incense so that, you know, it'll keep you seated without a clock. And, you know, you can, if you can stay there for the long sticks, and if you can stay there for 2 hours, you can build it up, you know. But whatever you can do. That's the longer you stay, the more privacy, so you could cry or laugh or whatever when you're writing, the better your writing will be. And then when you're done, you don't have to keep it. You can let it go. It's not about authorship. It's about spirit work.
Thank you. And there's a real wonderful thing in the book where you open up about a difficult writing process, which is really, I think, really helpful for all of us that are creating anything, just to hear that sometimes it takes time, sometimes you have to let things go, sometimes you have to let that humility in. It's a real treasure in the center.
The thing that gets me is, in the United States, we don't see humility as a great spirit power. We see it as something of subservience, because we live in such a hierarchical structure. But for indigenous communities, humility is a great strength. It's something that, you know, you give to those around you, to be of service, which is, as Gandhi said, the highest work we can do. No?
Thank you so much. I wonder, we have about 5 minutes, and I'm sure that there's some questions.
Hi there.
Hi.
So I brought my students with me today. I'm an English teacher out by Astoria, and we're reading House on Mango Street in our classroom. I just wanted to ask you, as the author with them here, 9th and 10th graders, what do you think is maybe the most important thing they can take from your stories, from Esperanza's story in that particular set of stories?
Well, I wrote that book so that people would come to understand many things. So I have to think about where I am now as opposed to where I was when I finished the book at 28. I really want young people to be responsible for making change in the world. And I think Esperanza understands that at the end of the story, that she has to come back. She has gifts. And if she wants things to change, she can't wait for the mayor to do it. She needs to do it herself. So that's one thing. But, you know, I'll add my own 2 cents now at 60, and that is young people really need to learn to earn their own money. You know, we don't owe a whole generation an income. And I don't understand where that reality has come from with the younger people that we're supporting. There are a lot of jobs there, and immigrants work 2 or 3 jobs very hard. They're the real American story about hard workers. So I don't know why we're subsidizing young people when they're past 21 years of age. You know, I just don't understand that. So earn your own money so you can do what you want. And no one is going to pay you for your art. So always assume to have a day job and you do your art at night. Or 2 day jobs. I'd never made any money from my writing until a substantial amount that I could quit my day job until after 20 years. So usually with self-employed people, they say, oh, you're not going to make any money the first 10 years. For writing, it's 20 years or possibly never. So always assume to get a day job, a good day job, because the more you earn your own money, the more you control your own destiny. And then a second thing very important for young men and women, you need to learn how to control your own fertility, because that can veer you off your dream, you know? And whatever your religious belief is, but you need to control your fertility, because if not, your fertility will control you. So very important, okay?
What about up in the oh, okay.
Yes. I'm here with Jessica Mendoza. I have the pleasure of having her as a student. We were wondering how you felt about writing when you were in high school.
How did I feel about writing when I was in high school? Well, you know, I started writing in about 6th grade, but basically very little of it people saw. And in high school, in my sophomore year, I had an English teacher who wrote poetry. And she discovered I could write poetry. I didn't write very good poems, but I wrote poems. You know, it was during the Vietnam War, so, you know, if you wrote poems that had Coca-Cola in them or something like that, we thought that was good, you know? And, you know, but she made me the poetry, the literary editor of the literary magazine, so I became known, I was kind of outed in my sophomore year as the writer, and I became the editor. So people knew I wrote. I think some of those magazines still exist to attest to how badly I wrote, but at least I wrote. I read a lot of poetry in high school. I think it was an apprenticeship time, and I think teenage years is the best time to write poetry, because poetry is about your secret self, and it's about telling the truth, not what everybody else wants you to believe. It's the little room in the house of your spirit where you could say anything you want. And I think as a nation right now, we need that room, because we're living in such a place of fear and censorship and to what we think. We can't even say what we think in these times politically. So we're back in being lonely adolescents again. And as a nation, I encourage everyone, especially in this time of such duplicitous talk on the media with politicians, which is the opposite of poetry, you know, to tell the truth. To tell your truth and tell it, because this is a time of silence and fear.
Okay. Okay, so this will be our last question before we whisk Sandra down, and I think it's right up here.
What message or words of advice would you have as a Chicana to other Chicanas and Latinas in the society who are trying to make a difference with their work, be it through art or writing or whatever medium that they choose, trying to have a positive impact on today's society?
Okay, I think this is, again, a time of época de susto, an era of terror and fear. And I think that all people of mixed races, you're ambassadors right now. You're being called to be ambassadors of everything. It's a big task. The communities are afraid of each other globally. We have communities coming into contact and mass migrations and unemployment and great fear at this time in history. It's an interesting time to be alive, but I think that people of mixed races are going to be asked to be ambassadors, people who are poor, people who are in the prisons, people who are living in the fringes really need to be the ambassadors of everything. And I think about serving as bridges during this time when communities are afraid to come into contact with each other, and especially right now when we're living in a time of extreme agoraphobia, Latinophobia, Mexophobia, immigrant phobia, homophobia, phobia. You know, this is a time for you to rise up and be a voice, to be a bridge.
We just heard from Sandra Cisneros and Elena Passarello from Wordstock 2015. With Wordstock 2016 just around the corner, we're delighted to have Elena here to look back at that conversation. Thanks a lot for being here, Elena.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
So I want to ask you, what was it like to be asked to interview Cisneros, and what does that prep look like for you?
I didn't know that I was going to be asked. I didn't expect that I was going to be asked. I just sort of put my name out there. Anything I can do to help Wordstock, I just wanted to be a part of it. And then the Amanda Bullock, the festival coordinator, sent me an email, and she said, I wonder if you might be interested in this. And I'm among the many, many people that read Sandra Cisneros in high school and again in college. And then when my writing life began, she always kept showing up. And so, of course, I was like, yes. Like, I read the first, you know, like three words of the email and just immediately hit the reply button. I was like, yes, whatever you need. And then the next sort of emotion for me was just panic, because right. Not only is she an icon, she's very important to me personally, but Wordstock is so huge, and I knew it was going to be just one of the big moments of the festival. So I was like, well, I shouldn't be doing this at all. And then I read her new book, and every sort of fear was allayed, because it just presents so many questions. It's this wonderful, confessional, interestingly structured memoir about her writing life and her creative life, and how that's sort of dovetails with, you know, her life with a capital L. And it was just so easy to think about questions that would welcome the audience into the book, and questions that I genuinely had. And then it just sort of was super easy.
So you said in that last answer that she was important to you personally. Can you talk a little bit about what that means or what that looks like?
Sure, yeah. And I know I'm not the only one. Like, that was the one thing that the Wordstock experience taught me, was that there are so many of us that have obviously spent decades with her writing kind of in our hearts. But when I was, like, 20 years ago, when I was in high school, I had the kind of cool older gal pal, you know, which when you're a book nerd, the cool girl is the one who's read like 100 more books than you have.
Right.
And she was like 3 years older than I was, and she was already in college. And we went to like the local Barnes and Noble, and I said, I have a gift certificate, pick me out 3 books. And she went straight to House on Mango Street and was like, this is it. This is the best book I read this year. And when like the cool girl from high school gives you the book, you know, the AP English, she already got a AP, you know, right. I was thinking it was gonna be like William Gass, you know, some kind of really intense, convoluted, you know, kind of whatever, maybe pretentious thing. And then I went home and I read it, and it's just this instantly accessible, musical, lively, hilarious female narrative. I was, you know, 15, 16 years old, and it was one of the 6 books in my life that I turned the back cover when I finished it, and then immediately flipped the book over and started it right over again. Because it's just, you know, it's just like the album that immediately grips you, or the film that you understand immediately, but it leaves you kind of wanting to dive back in and ask more questions. And again, I'm not like the one person in the world who's felt this way. I've heard so many other people, because I read Cisneros in college for a class and I teach now, where that was, that experience, that closeness was a part of their introduction to her.
Yeah.
And then later, in my semi-adult life, before I...
Your semi-adult life? Interrogate that for a second.
That's my 20s, you know, right?
It's not adolescence, but it's not adult. It's the semi-adult life.
Yeah, my semi-adult life. Right. It was great. I miss it in some ways. Everything was sort of, you know, not reliant on your tax returns or, or getting seven
that
hours
such
of sleep.
A depressing statement.
In my freewheeling youth. But I was an actor, you know, and I lived with a whole bunch of people and had no money and stuff. And my, you know, you have to, when you act, you have to have a whole bunch of different monologues that you do. So if they want you to come and play the girl next door, you have to have the girl next door monologue. Or you have to have the Shakespeare. And every once in a while I had to do like a sexy audition. And I used this great Sandra Cisneros poem from her book Loose Woman as my sexy audition.
Right.
So that she also meant a lot to me because she was in my wheelhouse. And I have to say, this is no insult to her, I never got a job off that sexy poem monologue. And then now as like a fully fledged grown up, you know, I teach at Oregon State University. We bring students in, freshman, sophomore, junior, taking those 200 level classes from all over the state, from all educational backgrounds and walks of life. And Cisneros is there, man. Like she is a part of the early reading experience of contemporary Americans.
Yeah.
Because all of the teachers are me, right? All of the teachers are these 30-something people or more, and who grew up on her books and understand that direct communication that Cisneros is able to do. So she's kind of, I mean, I wouldn't have thought about this until I started thinking about interviewing her, but she's very much present in a lot of kind of who I am and who a lot of people like me are, I think.
The cultural saturation that you reach at some point in your career when you write that many good books.
Yeah.
It's astonishing.
Well, I mean, and when House on Mango Street came out like 30 plus years ago, if you turned over the biography, the jacket copy that had her biography on the back, it said, you know, Sandra Cisneros was born in Chicago. She went here to school. She's been published here. And then the last line of the biography is, she's nobody's mother and nobody's wife. And
Right.
Which was shocking for me to read at 16. Not shocking, but it was like, you know, they let her put that down there. It wasn't shocking to be nobody's mother and nobody's wife. I mean,
right.
We were well into the third wave. But like that, I mean, I think I can name 40 writers who were probably empowered by a statement like that.
Right,
that,
as a feminist.
Yeah, or as a woman who, I mean, her writing is about being nobody's mother and nobody's wife, right? Carmelo, what she calls her breech baby of a book, is about that kind of raucous refusal. And Loose Woman, the poems that I was talking about from my ill-fated audition monologue, totally a part of that. And certainly House on Mango Street, this intense connection to family, who you are, your upbringing, as nebulous as it might be, right? Cisneros was constantly going from Chicago to vacationing and spending sometimes extended period of time to her family's house in her family's sort of ancestral home in Mexico. Having this nebulous sense of family and who you are, but not letting it completely infiltrate the art that you want to make, right? Like having it be a part of who you are, but not dictating something further.
Yeah, I'm not going to write the domestic novel because I'm a woman.
Right, and just because my novel has domesticity in it, it doesn't mean it's a domestic novel.
Right.
It's something else, right? But I love the magic that Sandra Cisneros can put into a scene that takes place on a street in downtown Chicago. That is, you know, Marquesian or, you know, the imagination of Bartleby, I think, is a part of this smaller, or not smaller, but this more sort of easily identifiable scenario, right? Or just, you know, waiting for a dude to call you on the phone, right? That she can put that kind of explosive, hysterical magic into, and I think that's a tradition that we can respectfully ascribe to her.
Yeah.
I think writers often have things that are challenging for them that they either avoid or should avoid. And then they have things that are challenging for them, and the rising to meet that challenge is what makes them good,
right? And not just great writers. I think all writers have to find the challenge that makes them better. And one of the major challenges of writing is how do you put sound on the page, right? Because it's just typeface. How do you make song happen? How do you describe vocality? And she is unbelievably good at putting sound. I think that's her obstacle that she just leaps over, and the joy of like hearing somebody evoke music, right? There's that great moment in House on Mango Street where the girl's singing Apples, Peaches, Pumpkin Pie, and she just writes it. She writes vocality, and she writes about Astor Piazzolla so well. Like, I don't know anybody really who is not trying to be a music writer who can write about all kinds of sound and all kinds of music as well as she can.
Yeah.
And that's been I've always wanted to steal how good she is, you know, doing that kind of stuff.
Yeah. To switch gears, mm-hmm. Was there something you wished you'd asked her that you did not ask her or did not have time to ask her in the recording or in that event at Wordstock?
Yeah, you know, it just flew by, as I'm sure you all just heard. And it's like improv theater. Like sometimes you'll be working with someone and you'll be like, oh no, the crowd and this person have some kind of a thing going on, and I just need to say my lines and not bump into the furniture, because this is an experience that you don't want to be a third wheel for this. And so the minute we sat down, I knew that this was going to be about that kind of connection. She's done it a million times, and the questions I think needed to be kind of simple and open-ended. And I really wanted to talk to her about, she looks like she's, you know, a spring chicken, but she's actually had a 4-decade-long career making things, lots right. of different things,
yeah.
Which is what that memoir is all about. And I desperately wanted to ask her how you stay creatively alive in your mind through decades, through successes, through extreme challenges. How do you weather a long career creatively?
Because creativity is essentially optimistic. To be creative, to want to be creative, you must be looking at the world in somewhat of an optimistic light.
Yeah.
Do you think?
Absolutely. And I think, I mean, if you look at her, if you listen to her, it seems like optimism is a real tide that she rides on. That and gratitude. Like, I think she said in the interview, or in the Q&A after the interview with someone, that you need to, before you begin your writing practice, find someone to be grateful to before you start, and you need to have someone that you think about in a positive way watching over you while you make things. So yeah, optimism and gratitude. But that, I mean, I wanted like a bullet pointed list of like things that
action items.
How can I still be as alive? And I mean, she was so generous in that interview and so generous with me. She was generous with the Powell's representative who was signing things. Not generous like kind, like generous like asking questions and opening herself up to the experience of knowing them. And I just wanted to be like, is there a part of your body that I can put a tap on and just like,
right.
just bottle right. some Cisneros right. juice? Because I think that's, I mean, she's so alive, and I just hope to be that alive when I'm 40, let alone when I'm, you know, 4 decades into a career.
Oh, wow.
You know, it's fascinating to be near people that are that tuned into themselves.
This has been Literary Arts, the Archive Project. It's a retrospective of some of the most engaging talks from the world's best writers for more than 30 years of literary arts in Portland. Join us next time for the Archive Project, a literary arts production in collaboration with Oregon Public Broadcasting. To hear more from the Archive Project, subscribe on iTunes. Our show is produced by Crystal Liguori for radio and podcast, with production help from Paige O'Rourke. Special thanks to the literary arts staff, board, and community. This show would not be possible without you. Thanks also to the band Emancipator for our theme music, and thanks to all of you for listening. I'm Andrew Proctor, and this has been another edition of the Archive Project from Literary Arts. Join us next time and find your story here.